Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first part of the show, we'll be talking with a writer. His name is Roy Kesey, and he's here visiting the campus under the sponsorship of the Carr Reading Series. This is presented by the English Department's Creative Writing Program, and throughout the academic year, at least, in the fall and the spring, they bring writers, poets, here to the campus to talk with student writers here, and also to give readings and talk about their work. And we've been fortunate here now over the years to have a number of these people on the program to talk about writing, theirs specifically, and writing more generally. And we're really pleased that Roy could be here to do this. He also will be giving a reading at, and this is part of the deal, the all of the guests here who visit for this series do give a presentation, and they'll be doing this reading this afternoon at 4:30. In the author's corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. That's at 809 South Wright in Champaign. It is free and open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend, feel welcome. He has published a collection of stories titled All Over, and also a novella, Nothing in the World, and Zank is the publisher on that. So if you're interested, you can stop by, I'm sure, and pick up a copy of them this afternoon. He's also published in a lot of different places. The list is kind of long, but just to mention a few, they include The Ninth Letter, which originates here at the University of Illinois, also American Short Fiction, McSweeney's, The Kenyon Review, The Paris Review, Granta, just to name a few. He has a MySpace page, so if you'd like to know a little bit more about him and where he's been published, you can look for him on the web. And we'll talk a little bit about his writing and a little bit about his background here this morning. And, of course, as always, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks very much for having me.
I think probably there are some writers who really take the plunge and go for the long form right away. There are some people who they sit down and the first thing that they do is they start a novel, or at least they start a longer thing. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in hearing from you a little bit about, though, what you think the appeal of the story is, the shorter form, as it seems that particularly for people who actually train as writers, that's the training ground. That's probably the place that you're encouraged to start.
Yeah, I think so.
What is there something in particular about the story form that you really like?
There is. There are a lot of things about it. If I could make one very quick correction to the intro.
Oh,
I
yes.
haven't yet been published in Granta or the Paris Review. Those are goals. Those are two magnificent magazines that I read fairly often.
Mm.
They're two of my favorite magazines, and I hope they're listening. But
I see. And it says here, and some excellent lit mags who haven't yet taken my bait.
There you
see,
go.
See, it's the fine print. It is literally in fine print, and I'm thinking, well, Paris Review, Granta, I'm going to mention those. That's a big deal.
They are a big deal.
All right. Soon to appear in Paris Review and Granta. Okay.
One can hope, yeah. To answer your question, there are a lot of things I like about the short story. To be fair, Nothing in the World is a novella, and that was the form that it ended up taking and probably the form that it wanted to take all along, but it did start out longer. I wrote first a short story that was interesting but not particularly successful, and then got all excited after I read a Vargas Llosa novel in Peru. That was the first book I read in Spanish when I was in Peru. And the structure of it got me all excited, and I thought, hey, that's something I could do with these voices that I have in this story that isn't working out. And so I wrote the novel, and then it turned out that only half of it was good. And fortunately, it was divided into two sort of narrative lines, two different main characters, and it was easy enough to just strip one of them out and let the story be about this other character, this Croatian soldier. And the book was a lot stronger for that, I think.
Hmm.
But in terms of short stories in general, I like what everybody likes about them. I like the in and outness of it. I like the intensity and the possibility for lyrical language that's harder to sustain over a long term. Everybody likes that, and it always makes me nervous to agree with everyone. So I've been thinking a little bit about the other things that I like about it, or the other things that lead me to spend time with it. And one of it, I think, is my interest in voice and in dictional registers that aren't common in the world that exists to the best of my knowledge, only in these stories that I'm working with. And a lot of those are sort of idiosyncratic. It's a fairly odd diction. And it gets a little bit cloying, at least in my work, if I try to stretch it out beyond 20 or 30 or 40 pages. The voice that being so different from the way most people speak, it tends to stop working at a certain point, and that's when I know that I've overwritten the character and I need to draw back and focus on what I've already got.
Yeah. I think, you know, sometimes when you read, there are some writers where, first of all, I guess you would say that all the characters essentially sound the same, and that you have to imagine that that's the voice of the writer, and that there's no attempt to create distinctive individual voices for characters. And it's interesting, not very long ago I talked with a fellow who was a mystery writer. You know, his work is good and is entertaining. But one thing that he said really struck me is he said he really believes that when you see a line of dialogue on the page, you should be able to tell who's speaking that without him telling you who that is.
Right.
And I thought, well, that's very interesting. But here now I'm sure that this gets to be much more challenging to try to create – or maybe you just somehow find them distinctive voices for characters.
Yeah, it is a challenge. And the more characters you have going in a given piece, the more of a challenge that it is. It is certainly the case in a lot of collections of short stories, and including a lot of very, very good collections, that you end up feeling sort of satiated after reading three or four of them in a row. And that happens, I think, because the voice is so similar. And it's this balancing act that you have to do, because you do want a reader to be able to read a story that doesn't have your name on it and to know that it's you. You want something that distinguishes you in that way. But the danger there is that if you have all of your stories, if all of your stories are using that voice that's very, very close to whatever, whether it's your interior voice or the voice that you actually use when speaking to other people, the stories do tend to sound the same and they start to bleed into each other. And that's one of the things that I was hoping to avoid in this collection in All Over. And I think that the danger when you do that, the danger when you pull back from having a single narrative voice informing all the stories, is you risk losing a sense. That's one way to give a sense of coherence to a collection. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want it to be the way I gave coherence to this collection. I wanted to use a sense of sort of formal playfulness that informs all of these stories. And that's really the only thing that they have in common. But I wanted to use that to give cohesion to the collection rather than a single voice.
So did you write these stories to be a collection, or did you just look at everything that you had written and said, okay, I would like to have this one and this one and this one, and put them together with some idea about what it was that you want?
Yeah, and it would definitely the latter case. Because the contracts for books started to come my way fairly late in the game, I had When Design started to get interested, I had more than two books worth of stories, and I had a novel, and I had a lot of other sort of spare bits that could be fitted in here or there. And I went back and forth for a long time over which stories to include. And the way that many collections are put together, they sort of all want to explore a given geographical area or a given time period or a given type of character. That's another way to give cohesion to a collection, and I'm kind of bored with all those ways. It's not that great collections can't be put out even now that do things that way, but it wasn't a way that I really wanted to approach this material. So I had 8 years worth of stories that, I had 50 stories probably that I thought were still interesting. They were still interesting to me, and we're still working with problems that I found interesting problems. And so I had to find some other way of getting the material to sort of cohere. In marketing speak, I needed a hook, and this book's hook is that it doesn't have one. There's no commonality between the stories, other than the sense of experimentation with form. So that I realized that was my central sort of obsession with this material, and so I just put all the stories that I had. I made this huge chart with crayon because I have young children, and the spectrum between really hardcore sort of experimental forms and then much more realistic work. And I just put every story where it fit on that continuum and drew a line down the middle and said, okay, I'm going to work with these stories. And that way, form is going to be the central question of this book, of this gathering of stories. And I felt so much better once I'd figured that out. But once I realized that I didn't have to hook all the stories together with common characters or time or space. And so that was the way I went about it. And then it was just a question of figuring out, of looking at beginnings and endings of story of stories and figuring out what the best order would be to sort of gain a certain sense of momentum and forward motion and leading the reader from one story to the next, with the hope that the voices are distinct enough that that sense of satiation that I was talking about before wouldn't occur.
Our guest is Roy Kesey. He's a writer. The book we're talking about, the collection of stories, is All Over, and the novella, he also mentioned, Nothing in the World. The publisher is Dzanc, and that's spelled D-Z-A-N-C, if you want to go looking for it. They're in Michigan, and his name is last name spelled K-E-S-E-Y, and he's here visiting the campus as part of the Carr Reading Series. It's sponsored by the English Department's Creative Writing Program. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if people would like to call in. Just to give people a little bit more information about you, starting with where you are now, and maybe we work backwards, you live in Beijing.
That's right.
Because your wife is in the Peruvian Foreign Service.
That is
and
exactly
she was
right.
Posted there, so that's how you ended up in Beijing.
Yeah, that's right. We were in Peru. It was even before we got married that she started talking about becoming a diplomat, and I thought that was fantastic because that's kind of how I like to live, and that's how I've lived for 10 or 15 years before I'd met her, going to a place I didn't know for a couple of years, and I like to work. I don't like to feel like a tourist. I like to get a job and pay my taxes and be able to complain about the same things that the taxi drivers are complaining about. So that's what I'd been doing. And then when I heard that that's what she wanted to do, I thought that was a fantastic idea. So she went into the Diplomatic Academy, which is how you become a diplomat in Peru. We went back and in Peru, you get to give a short list of places that you'd like to go, postings that you'd like to have. And we spent 6 months going back and forth over that list, from 15 down to 12, down to 10, down to 5, down to 3, and then realizing none of those 3 was exactly what we wanted. And we felt that we were still sort of young and energetic enough that we could, and our children also were young enough, they were very young at that point, that we could take them to someplace radically different from the United States or from Peru, that we still had the energy to deal with a new language family, that we, all of those things that are part of the gig. And so we kept thinking about it. We kept working through it. And there were places that we both like very much, but we kept thinking that we needed, that we were in a position to take on a slightly bigger challenge. And so when she looked up from a book one night and said, China, I knew exactly which conversation that pertained to, even though it wasn't one we were having at the moment. And I knew that she was exactly right, and that was, even though China had never been on any of the lists until that moment, we both just knew it was right. And it was a posting that we didn't have to compete too hard for, because it's so far away from Peru and it's seen as so foreign to Peru that it's not a position that's sought after as eagerly as Madrid or D.C. or Paris.
And how long have you been living there now?
4 years. Four and a half almost.
And how old are your kids?
My daughter is 6 and my son is 5.
Yeah. So are they trilingual?
Quadrilingual.
So they speak English, Spanish, Chinese, and
French.
And French.
Yeah, they're in the French school. Yeah.
Excellent.
We want to keep them confused and kind of on their toes.
Well, I'm sure that for them, it's maybe they don't really know it now, but I would say for them that this is a remarkable experience and opportunity to be able to have.
We hope so. We hope so. We're a little bit, at the beginning especially, we were a little bit worried. We thought this is the life we've chosen. It's not the life they've chosen. It's perhaps not the life they would choose. And then we felt a little better when we realized that no child gets to choose their life. As children, we are all given a life to live, and we sort out from the information we gain and the experiences that we have what sort of life we'd like to have in the future once we get to make up our own minds about it. I think China has been a very fruitful place for them in terms of the languages. they're a little disappointed to learn that other people don't speak all of those things, and they're very aware of other people speaking to them in what is not the other person's native language, and they have very little patience for that at all. We'll have American friends who come over who speak fluent Chinese, but they can look at them and know that they're not Chinese, and they will answer them in English. And the expression on their face is, you know, come on.
Why are you doing this?
Yeah, very good.
I'm sure that there must be ways in which your writing is influenced by being in a kind of alien place, or at least, you know, it may be by this point you're starting to feel more at home. But I'm sure it must have been very strange at the beginning.
Sure, that's a really good question. I don't honestly think that any writer or anyone who wants to be a writer needs to feel like they need to go out and get into a totally alien situation in order to gather material. It's one way of doing it, but I believe that in anybody's desk drawers or in anybody's closet, literal closet, there's more than enough information and material for any kind of book. I don't think you have to go across the oceans to gather stuff. But that said, it's just kind of the way I'm geared. It's easier for me to deal with the things that come with a move to a radically different place and life in a radically different place, which in China means dealing with bureaucracies and dealing with this new language and new flora and fauna and the intestines, that sort of thing. It's just easier for me to deal with that than it is for me to sit still.
Can you actually point to some specific way that you would think that something you're writing about, or maybe the approach to it, you could say now, having been in China, I can say that, is there nothing so specific so that you would say, here I can draw a line between the fact that I'm living in China, have been for these years, and something in my writing?
I'm sure there is. My instinct is to punt on this and say, you know, we'll let graduate students of 30 years from now figure that out if they're inclined to. But yeah, I'm sure there is. I'm sure there is. I think that sort of influence was stronger when I was younger. I know that, for example, I moved to France right out of college, and so I was reading, but it wasn't so much a factor, I think, of living in France as it was reading a set group of French authors whose voices influenced me to a far greater extent than was healthy. But that's kind of what we all do. We copy the people we love, and the stories are bad, and they don't need to be in the world. The world doesn't need them, and so we throw them away and move on from there. We figured out that you can take mechanisms in other people's work and undo them and rebuild them with sort of extra bits that you've picked up along the way and use them to serve your own writing instead of, you know, the world doesn't need me writing more Bartholomew stories or Calvino stories. They're already in the world. The world already has them. So specifically to China, it would be difficult for me to point to anything specific in terms of craft. In terms of content, there are some things, but I'm really suspicious of exoticism in fiction, in writing of any kind, I guess. I'm suspicious of this instinct to see everything as inherently interesting just because I haven't seen it before. A lot of these things are not inherently interesting, and they make the locals roll their eyes because everyone who comes there finds them fascinating for the first week that they're there. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, that sort of us versus them-ness is something I try to stay away from. That said, there are interesting things that you see and that you are interested by, and you can just sort of live with those things for a while, and if 6 months down the road they're still interesting to you, there still are symbolic possibilities, there still are ways to use this content, then I feel a little bit safer putting them into stories. But I still often, and this is the case with, I guess, two stories in this collection, I take those things out of context, and I bring them to a nameless space, if that's the kind of story I want to write, or I put them somewhere else entirely, somewhere else that I know, and I just see if I can get interesting echoes going back and forth between this phenomenon or event that I saw in China and sort of recontexted, put in another place or in the mouth of another sort of character. And sometimes it works out.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that in a lot of ways, daily life for anybody in China is kind of like, you know, daily life anyplace else. You get up, you have breakfast, you go to work, you got to go to the store, you got to do what you do. You take care of your family, your kids, you go to the movies or, you know, whatever people do for entertainment, and you just kind of go along.
Yeah.
Having said that, though, in what way is your life distinct because of the place? I mean, what really is daily life like?
Well, I think your instinct was a good one. It's not a great deal different than it is from, I mean, you know, I've got two young kids and I've got a wife that I love very much and like, which is nice. We get to hang out in the evenings, and that's one of my favorite parts of the day. And so because of her job, I'm very fortunate. I'm in a position to just be at home writing during the day when my kids are at school. And so that's my morning and early afternoon, is sitting in front of my desk, staring at my computer screen, hoping for something good. And then I pick my kids up after school, and I take them home, and we play with the rabbits, which my wife tells me are now much, much bigger than when I left 2 weeks ago. That has me a little worried. Playing with the kids downstairs, hanging out with her in the evenings, getting together with friends. So in that sense, life is very, very normal. But I also, I write a column for a glossy magazine in Beijing, and I do the dispatches for McSweeney's, and those two things prod me to get outdoors and be looking for interesting corners and interesting moments, and to be aware of differences in the light than you would see anywhere else. And those sorts of things are, when that kind of thing comes out in the writing, then you know that place is affecting your life and your brain and the way you go about your work.
Yeah. Well, our guest in this part of Focus 580, Roy Kesey, he's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois as part of the CAR reading series for fall 2007. This is presented by the English Department's Creative Writing Program. He'll be doing a reading this afternoon at 4:30 in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore, 809 South Wright Street in Champaign. He has a MySpace page. That may be one of the easiest ways to find more about him and learn about him and his background and his writing. And you can also look for his books, Nothing in the World, that's a novella, and All Over, that's a story collection published by DeZanc Books. DZANC is the spelling. And I'm sure that they probably have a few copies down at the bookstore.
I think
you want to take
a
look at him. And you should also feel free to stop by and hear him and meet him this afternoon, 4:30. That's free and open to the public. Anybody interested should feel welcome to stop by. And here on the show, questions are welcome too, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Nothing in the World is a war story.
Yes.
And the central character is this young man. He's a Croatian, and it's set in the war in former Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
It's a story here about a young man who is seized by patriotism and his desire to defend the motherland, whatever that means. He doesn't seem real clear on what that does mean.
He's 17. He's not clear on anything.
All right. Well, that, fair enough. So, and he goes off and discovers maybe he does have a talent for killing, which is useful in war, but doesn't really seem to know exactly why he's there, exactly who he's fighting. And I suppose one of the things it says is about the kind of wars that are fought nowadays don't make a whole lot of sense. There aren't clear lines. Their civilians are always in the crossfire. And it's, I'm sure, as difficult often for the people who participate in these wars to figure them out as it is for people on the outside looking in trying to figure them out.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. And he grows up sort of isolated. He grows up on an island off the coast. And so he doesn't have contact with a whole lot of the things that he comes into, that he has to interact with in the course of the book. And that's just sort of another layer of difficulty for him, you know, aside from the fact that he's carrying a gun and that he has missions, but he's never entirely clear on what they are for a variety of reasons.
Mm. Where did this character come from?
Well, he's sort of a composite of a couple of people that I met. I was in Croatia three times altogether, 1990, 92, and 93. So I was there before the war started. I was there during the hot war when things were messy. And then again, when the front lines had stabilized, Serbia had about a third of Croatia in their power, and it was 2 more years before Croatia pushed them out. So the book starts off with, was started by things that I saw there and heard about and read about. And the character just at the beginning, as I mentioned before, it was a short story. Mm-hmm. It was in 4 fragments, and it was meant to be slightly ambiguous whether all 4 fragments related to the same character or not. And that may have been one of the reasons that story was not very successful. Once I realized that I would be better served to make all of them, or three of the 4 anyway, apply directly to him, to a single consciousness, to a single person, everything started to come together much more cleanly. I don't want to give too much away about the book, but there's one of the more striking episodes in the book was something that happened while I was there, while I was in the city of Split in 92.
Really? That thing really happened?
It did.
Did it?
Yeah.
Wow.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do know what you're talking about. Absolutely. And I wish I could say, but I won't.
I was about 200 yards away.
Oh, wow. That, it's, so I guess that you'd think, well, however did you come up with something like that? Well, you didn't make it up. It actually happened.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Was this, did you at some level think that you wanted to say something about war? Was this the kind of thing where maybe it came out of wanting to really, in a sense, make it a statement about the stupidity, the senselessness of war, this one in particular, but maybe war in general? Did you have some sort of mission?
No, I really didn't. The mission is always to serve the text. The mission is to get the words right and to do justice to a given character or set of characters. It's funny. I feel most comfortable when I'm a decade behind the curve, no matter what curve that is. Now in China, you know, there are lots of outlets for writing about China. Everyone wants to know about China. And I'm really pretty sure that that's not what I want to be doing. I'll let everyone else battle it out, and I'll, you know, once I've sort of processed, it takes me a while to process things that I see and hear, and I want to think about them. I don't want to get them wrong. So that was one of the things that happened with this, and the fact that there happens to be another war to which comparisons might be made in terms of the text and what's going on in the world, that was just... coincidence. Yeah. That said, I would feel more awkward than usual denying that there are conclusions that can be drawn from this portrait of war and this and the effects of it on a given person or a given set of people. Mm-hmm. So I won't even try. But I'll let other people tease those threads out, I think.
Yeah. It, I think it's a very powerful story, and one of the things that make it powerful, I think, in a sense, is it feels real. It feels authentic. It somehow feels like you couldn't really just be making this up. You had to have been there. That it has a certain sense. And I wonder how it is that, you know, how you achieved that.
Well, thank you, first of all. I think it's a question of getting the little things right. This is something that I say to students, and I've said on a panel that I was just at down at the University of Iowa. Get the trees right. If you get the trees right, everything else falls into place. You know, I really do believe that these bigger questions boil down to craft questions. And if you're paying attention and you're getting the small details right, everything else will line up, and it might take 5 drafts, or it might take 15, or it might take 40, but sooner or later they'll all start to line up. And I don't believe, at least I don't believe strongly, that you have to live through anything to write about it. I think there are a lot of things that you can desk jockey. There's a lot of things that you can figure out in other ways, and I do a lot of research. This book took a tremendous amount of resource, and I was very fortunate that some of the friends that I'd made in that area were willing to read the text and help me get the trees right. Trees standing in for everything, every kind of detail. So I was fortunate in that respect, and they did. They helped me get the roofs right, and spices that are sold at the market in the first chapter of the book. They made sure that I got all those things right. And when you're sort of paying intense attention at that level, you can at least hope that everything else will come together and that it will feel real. It's not, strictly speaking, realist fiction, although it's about as close as I get. There are a few trips down rabbit holes here and there. But I did want that. I did want a sense of realism. I wanted it to feel real, but I also wanted it to feel slightly archaic, and so there are bits where the language gets sort of old. It's an older diction, it's an older feeling sort of language, and I guess I wanted that so that the book would not be only about one moment in history or only about one war, so that it would be applicable to more things. But I mean, you know, the first great war story in American literature has got to be The Red Badge of Courage. And, of course, Stephen Crane famously had not seen the things that he was writing about, and it feels real. So I think in the right hands, you can certainly have very, very real feeling text from someone who hasn't necessarily experienced it firsthand. And I feel very grateful for that fact and very fortunate that that's the case, because otherwise we could only ever write about ourselves, and that would probably get boring pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, and at the same time, it does feel real. I would certainly underscore that. It also has a slightly hallucinatory quality to it, as if the main character doesn't really – he's not quite in control. Well, he's not in control. He's not in control of what happens to him. It's almost not in control of where he goes, and – It has a wandering, slightly nightmarish kind of quality that you feel that this guy is stuck in this, doesn't exactly know what he's there for, doesn't exactly know where he's going. He sort of has an idea, but it's almost like he's blown from one place to another.
Well, I did want this sense that that there were forces beyond his own will that are moving him around, and sometimes those forces move him in directions that are useful to him, and sometimes in directions that are very dangerous or unuseful to him. And I just wanted that sense that his agency, his ability to act, is operating on a really small scale. And that doesn't mean that they're unimportant or insignificant. You know, we're all making small but significant moral decisions or ethical decisions all the time. And so I wanted those to be a factor in his life. But I also wanted this sort of overarching awareness that, you know, there are powers beyond his understanding moving him around.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, here, our guest this morning is Roy Kesey. The book that we have just been talking about here, since we were talking about it, I want to mention the title again. The novella is Nothing in the World. And then there's a collection of stories all over. DeZank is the publisher, and I'm sure that he'll be talking about his writing this afternoon at the Illini Union Bookstore, and they will have books. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of the show. A little bit earlier, you were talking about when you were younger and working on learning writing, that you, and I'm sure that a lot of young writers do this, there were writers that you really liked, admired their style, and so you were writing, in a sense, you would try to write something like them.
Right.
And were smart enough to recognize, no, this, it's not them, it's not me, we'll just throw those away and we'll start again. It seemed that all of the people that I know who write and the people who I've met are voracious readers.
Sure.
They're reading all the time. And one of the things that I wonder is how it is that you manage even unconsciously to absorb something from somebody else's work and have that end up in yours. If you're reading that much of other writers, other people who write fiction, mm-hmm. how do you keep your stuff separate from that?
It's really, really hard at first, and I, as a writer, was unsuccessful at it, and those are the stories that got thrown away. Now, there are a couple of things that happen. One is that one of the benefits or luxuries of having done this for a while is that I recognize much more quickly when a story is not going to work. And one of the reasons that it might not be working is that I'm relying too much on the work of somebody else or another voice that I've read. And for whatever other reason that a story might not be working, I would do 10 drafts of those stories and spend a month or two on them. And now I'm catching it in the first paragraph or two and throwing that away and moving on to something else. So that's nice. How we realize when the light bulb goes on and we realize that we need to be reading as writers instead of reading as readers. That's, I think, a big moment, and it happens at different points in different people's lives. But what I mean by that is, you read when you start, you read as a child and as a younger adult, and sometimes even as an adult, and this comes as kind of a luxury once you've started building a life as a writer. You're reading to get caught up. You're reading to no longer be sitting in your chair. You're reading to be carried into this other world that is more or less similar to our own, and to forget that you are there, right? Mm. You read to be carried into this other writer's mind. And that's fun. I mean, there is a great deal of pleasure to that, and I think that is the first pleasure, and I think writers that forget that that is the first pleasure or do so at their peril, which is not to say I've never forgotten it. I have. But when you realize that you need to start reading as a writer, that is reading for those, oh my God, moments, and not simply experiencing them, but going back to the bit of text that caused that moment in your brain and saying, how did the reader caused those three words to appear in my brain? What was the mechanism through which that change in my brain was affected? And so there are mechanisms that you can create to do this, and you go to them and you break them down, and you don't take them you don't simply take them and plop them down in your own work, A, because that's uninteresting, and B, because it almost never works. But you break it down, you take it apart piece by piece, and you look at it, and you try to see, you attempt to figure out a way to make some similar but distinct machine working in your own work.
This is something that I wonder about too, whether as a writer, when you read, if you're reading as a writer, whether you can simply become absorbed in the story and read it and think, well, gosh, what a great story, or whether you're somewhere on some level you're looking at it technically and you're saying the writer, what this writer is doing, you say, oh, he she did this, they did this, oh, look at the way they did this, and that you can't just approach it and say, oh gosh, great story. You're absorbed in thinking about the technical aspect.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I remember there's a great bit in Mark Twain's autobiography where he's talking about the difference between being on the river as a passenger and being on the river as a captain. And every single bit, it's a beautiful passage, but every single bit of beauty represents a danger. And so the extract is often titled by itself. It's a part of a chapter, but it's often titled "Reading the River," and I love that metaphor, and I love introducing that bit to students because it's such a perfect way to talk about reading and writing, where every passenger on his boat on the Mississippi is seeing a beautiful glint off the water. To him, it means problems coming, and learning to read the river as a captain. That's the only way to become the captain, right? That's the only way to get your own boat, is to be able to recognize those dangers. But you lose the ability to see the beauty. The sunset no longer is a sunset. It is an indication of weather to come, and I like that very much. And he laments the loss of the ability to simply see beautiful things as beautiful things. And it's true. It becomes the more reading you do, and the more reading you do specifically looking at craft or at technique, the harder it is to get swept up. But it still happens. Mm-hmm. It still happens, and I treasure those moments when it does happen, when I can just simply close the book at the end and say, wow, great story. Yeah. I love that. I love it when that happens. But on the other hand, I've got a boat. I've got a boat, and so I have to be able to recognize the beautiful moments. And what it generally leads to is me reading everything twice. I'll read it to be swept away, mm-hmm. and then I'll go back and say, all right, what does that tree branch mean, and what can I do with tree branches on my own river?
Yeah,
that sort of thing.
Nice, very nice. We have talked a little bit about you, about the fact that now you're living in Beijing, and that the reason you ended up there was you had been living in Peru and fell in love with and got married to a woman who went into the Peruvian Foreign Service, and then the idea was, well, where is she going to go?
Right.
So you ended up there. You talked about having lived in France, so you have lived in a number of different places, including in Peru. What is it that has driven you from place to place?
I don't know. It is this feeling that I want to see everything. I like seeing things. And that was a gift that my parents gave me, I think. They travel a bit now. They went to Africa this year and had a great time. But when I was growing up, we didn't travel. And that never got in the way of my mother and father pointing things out to me and teaching me the value of sitting very still and looking very carefully at what's going on around you, appreciating very, very small things. And then from there, it just becomes a question of learning the importance of doing the work to get yourself in a position, a physical position, to see things that there's no other way to see. And whether that means the top of a mountain or the bottom of a canyon or the depths of a rainforest, being willing, most people never see things except on the Discovery Channel because they're, for whatever reason, disinclined to do the physical work it takes to get to these places. And that's fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that at all. But I do know that my life has been enriched by those moments when I got to see things. And I lived in Peru for 8 years. I went down there not intending to stay quite that long, but I was thinking, you know, 2 or 3 years, kind of what I'd been doing before. And, I must have been 6, I guess, or 7 when I saw a documentary of Machu Picchu, the great Inca ruins near Cusco. And then there was, I don't know, 3 or 4 years when we didn't have a television. My father announced that he'd taken it to the shop to get it fixed, and it must have been hard to fix because it took 3 or 4 years before we got it back. It must have been a really complicated problem. But that moment stuck with me, and so when I got back from Europe, I came back from my sister's wedding, but I didn't have a plan, an immediate plan for the next couple of years, and I went down to Central America for a little while, enjoyed it, liked the language, wanted to be able to read it well enough to read some of my favorite authors that I'd only read in English up to that point. And but really, I just went down because I wanted to see.
What is, as a, in when you were in college, what sort of things did you study? What's the extent you have formal academic training, what is it in?
I have 2 weeks of undergraduate study in business. My father convinced me that that was the kind of thing that would serve me well no matter what I ended up doing, and I'm sure that that's true. He didn't tell me that that would be something I would be spectacularly bad at. And so it didn't take me very long to figure out. This was at Georgetown, and I had some extraordinary professors in philosophy and literature, and I think that's what often happens. We get extraordinary professors in something, and we are drawn to their charisma and their way of addressing the content and the content itself. And so those were the two things that kind of took over my brain. And so I was at Georgetown for 2 years and then dropped out and wandered around for a little while and then finished the philosophy in England and then came back to the U.S. and finished the literature.
Yeah. So I want to hear more about your father. I like the idea. At the time, it would seem when you were a kid, the idea of throwing out the TV, I think, might have been a slightly radical notion.
Well, we were kind of slow. We really thought he was going to bring it back.
Tell me more about him. What kind of guy is he?
He's a great guy. He's he's about to retire from his position as an administrator at a community college, and that's something that he's been doing for decades now. And he actually held on so that I could go to his retirement party, because I don't get back to the States too often. But, you know, in the course of this book tour, I talk my way into 3 days at the end of it with them in California. And so I'll be going back to spend time with them and attend his retirement party. And I'm looking forward to that. I think it's also going to be a bit of a roast, and I'm also looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. What sort of a guy is my father? He's a man of tremendous integrity, and he laughs easily and loudly. He tells good stories, and he takes forever to tell them. I think he's very aware of tactile pleasures, whether it's in the garden or holding a book or eating. He's very aware of the kind of pleasure that comes from those sorts of things, and he gave those to all of us. It was sitting in his lap that I learned to read. Yeah, I'm grateful to him for an awful lot of things.
Mm-hmm. So how much longer do you think that you'll be living in China? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, we'll be there for another 9 months or so, and then the posting ends in June, I think. And then my wife wants to do a master's in public administration, so we'll be back in the States for a year. And then it'll be the basic diplomatic deal with, if you're Peruvian, is 3 years home, 6 years abroad. Mm-hmm. So after the year here, which is just kind of a flyer that we're taking, we'll be back in Lima, and she'll be working at the foreign ministry there for 3 years. And then we'll figure out somewhere else to go. And It's just sort of 3 and 6 and 3 and 6 until you die.
So of what country are you a citizen?
I like everywhere. But I am a citizen of the United States, and I've it would be a lot easier for me administratively to get a Peruvian passport, but I don't want to give up my American passport, especially because, you know, I'm only 40, and so the U.S. Olympic basketball team, they could call at any moment and say, man, we need you. We need you dropping threes. So, you know, I want to be eligible for that.
Okay. Well, I would probably say don't quit your day job, but it's a good thing to have goals. And, you know, if you can still get out there and pound the hardwood, I'd say, you know, more power to you. If your knees are still okay at 40, yeah, keep going. Do you, again, I know we're sort of bouncing all over, but I'm interested in I guess going back to this idea of voice, of distinctive voice, your interest in having characters that have distinctive voices or distinctive ways of speaking and that's the thing that maybe sets them apart and sets particular stories apart. Do you actually hear them? Do you hear the characters?
Yes, but not in that sort of fun way that you see in movies. It's always just every single story that I've ever written that has worked out has started with a bit of phrasing, and often it's only two or three words, and I'll hear it, I'll say it or think it, and it will not sound like me, and that is the moment that I know I have a new character, and sometimes I'll leave in the middle of conversations to go think about it. And I don't, you know, it is me. It's coming from me, but it's a twist on how I would normally phrase things when I'm talking to you or talking to my kids or talking to my wife or friends. I know what my diction sounds like, and a lot of times it's sort of going for a punchline. And so twisting the phrasing very slightly sometimes makes things funnier. And I'll hear it, and I'll know that it's a bit of phrasing that I've never heard before. There's just a slightly different sort of lilt or music to it, and it's certainly not the only way to start stories. I don't know too many people that start stories this way, but I'm always interested, and I always end up thinking, who talks like that? What kind of person and what kind of life leads to that kind of phrasing and that kind of voicing? Because everything that has been a part of our life up until now influences the way we discuss things. Mm-hmm. And so I'll have this bit of phrasing, and I'll start wondering about who this person is that speaks this way. And, you know, there are always issues of gender and race and class and education and everything else. But it's the smaller bits that I'm looking for, the smaller moments that influence the way that we talk. And so I'll have, you know, that bit of voicing gets me a character, and then all I have to do is get him or her in some trouble and then hopefully get him out.
And it just comes from somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it comes from me. It is me. Yeah. But it's this urge to be continuously find new ways to say things, both in the course of just normal conversations and in writing.
Mm-hmm. Do you have some ambition to do something long, really, an actual novel, an actual?
Sure.
He laughs. An actual novel.
Yeah. I'm working on. I've signed to turn one in March, as a matter of fact, and it was a novel that I thought it was finished. I was up to the eighth or ninth draft of it, and I thought it was done. But it still had some issues, and so I set it aside and worked on other stuff and finished a few more stories, and then went back to it. And the rewriting of it, the restructuring of it, is a tremendous amount of work, but it's good work. It's fun work. And, you know, what I normally do is overwrite and then pare down and polish and end up, you know, 10 or 15% shorter than what I started with. This is going the other direction, and I have no idea where it's going to end. It was probably 110,000 words when I started working on it this time around, and I'm now at 130, and there's no end in sight.
No. Our guest, Roy Kesey, is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. His visit is part of the Fall 2007 Carr Reading Series that's presented by the English Department's Creative Writing Program. If you'd like to find out more about him and his writing, the places he's published, something more of his background, you can look for his page on MySpace. So that would be one thing you could do. You could this afternoon go to the Alina Union Bookstore at 4:30. That's at 809 South Wright in Champaign. He'll be doing a reading, and you can hear him, meet him, and you can also look for his books All Over. That's a collection of stories, and the novella we have talked about, Nothing in the World, published by Dzanc, D-Z-A-N-C is the publisher. His last name, K-E-S-E-Y, Kesey, Roy Kesey. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Our program, Focus 580, made possible in part by Bevere Cafe and Bevere Cafe 2 on the U of I campus. Bevere Cafe offers continental breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11, lunches from 11:30 to 1, Tuesday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe, student-operated and newly remodeled on the second floor of Bevere Hall at the corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana. We will break for an update on the markets and news, then we'll be back with more Focus, so please stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Let's jump right in and look at the current tick in Kansas City. December wheat at 809.5, up 3.25. July 686, up a quarter. At the Chicago Board of Trade, December wheat 784, up 5.5. July 667, down 3. December corn, 375.25, down 1.75. March, 392.25, down 2.25. May, 403, down 1. December of next year, 423.75, down 1.75. November beans, 1003.5, up 1.75. January, 1019, up 2.25. March, 1033.25, up 2.25. November of next year, 9.